Let me just do that one more time. December 28th, 2019. And we are looking at this morning something that's related to the time of the year in 2019. What is this week? Happened this week or is happening?
Football bowl season.
Right. But in the calendar?
The new year.
The new year. Okay. Not quite yet, but what's already happened?
We've had Christmas and we're heading up to circumcision and Epiphany.
Right. So we had Christmas, we had the birth of Jesus in the, I guess we call it the Western Christian calendar, and we had Hanukkah, which this year coincided quite nicely, and then we have the New Year coming up, January 1st. But before we get to that, and what Jim just mentioned with the Epiphany and circumcision, Hanukkah is the holiday that remembers what specifically?
The cleansing of the temple.
The cleansing of the temple.
Maccabees.
The Maccabees revolted.
The
light of the menorah. How long did it last for, the light?
8 days.
Okay. So, just so that we all, I assumed everybody knew that, but just want to put it out there. We have 8 days of light. The oil lasts in the temple after it's been defiled. It's called a miracle in the Talmud. But what's the oldest description of Hanukkah that we have? Okay, so it's not a Jewish book. Okay, Maccabees is a Jewish book. Sorry, it is a Jewish book. What I meant to say is it's not preserved by the rabbis. It's preserved by the Catholic Church. Okay, so that's
not canonical, right, to the rabbis.
Well, right. But my point is it's not...
it's not part of their canonical text.
Right, and so it's interesting that you have a Christian book that's preserving a very Jewish tradition. I would even say a Jewish nationalistic tradition.
What do you mean? The Book of Maccabees is a Christian book?
Yeah.
It's in the Christian Bible.
Yeah,
yeah. It doesn't exist. It's not like in the Mishnah. What I'm saying is it's not written in the Talmud. It's not written in the... Not the Book of Maccabees. You have...
Right.
Yeah.
Orthodox.
Yeah.
Orthodox.
Right. Correct. But not in the Protestant or the one that the evangelicals. Right. Right.
We can boast John chapter 10. Thank you very much.
Right.
Well, that's the first recorded celebration.
That's exactly what it is.
So we're referring to John 10. Jesus comes up to the Feast of Dedication, and everybody knows the word Hanukkah is dedication, and like, you know, Enoch. His name is Hanoch, which is also some of the same root of dedication. And that's what they did to the temple way back when Solomon first dedicated it, the first temple. So, all of this to say, it's remembered in the Book of Maccabees. And so, I'm if you happen to have Maccabees, you probably don't. But I'm looking in 1 Maccabees, chapter 1. And I just want to just refresh our memory about what was it? Who was the bad king in the story?
Antiochus Epiphanes.
He's the fourth, right? There's first, second, third, like King John or King Richard or whoever, but he's the fourth, and he gets this name Epiphanes, which is not... It's a derogatory nickname. That's right. It's not. From what I remember, it's not something that he gave himself. So I'm just gonna. And what? Essentially, what's the story? Is it? How is he involved? What's his agenda?
His agenda is to Gentilize or to paganize the temple, or the community, the whole community, really.
Okay.
And the battle was that the Maccabees wanted to defeat him, and the first person that they killed in this whole thing was actually a Gentilized Jew. It was a Jew who was worshipping in the temple. I forget his name. But he was murdered as a sort of sign that we are the holy ones. We're the separated ones. We're the ones who are going to fight the Gentile force that's coming upon us.
Right.
His father, wasn't their father killed in refusing to it wasn't circumcision.
You're talking about the father of the Maccabees. No, he wasn't killed. He actually led the
revolt.
He's the one who killed, who Jim was talking about, who killed the Gentilizing Jew. So this is one of the things I wanted to bring out is if you were looking at 1 Maccabees 1, verse 11, this is what it says. At that time, there appeared in the land of Israel a group of traitorous Jews who had no regard for the Torah and who had a bad influence on many of our people. They said, "Let's come to terms with the Gentiles, for our refusal to associate with them has brought us nothing but trouble." This proposal appealed to many people, and some of them became so enthusiastic about it that they went to the king and received from him permission to follow Gentile customs. And this is what that entails. They built in Jerusalem a stadium, like those in the Greek cities. They had surgery performed to hide their circumcision. And what that is they basically took some flesh and they sewed it back on so that they wouldn't stick out. Because when you were involved in sports back then, you did it naked. And so, nude, whatever you want, how you want to say it. And so you immediately knew if someone was Jewish or not, because you see them. And they abandoned the Holy Covenant, started associating with Gentiles, and did all sorts of other evil things. Okay, so first off, it's not like this bad guy showed up and said, "Hey, do what I am saying, you know, I'm going to basically beat you into submission." Just like in the days of Hitler or the days of any invading force, there are, like in Norway, what was it, Quisling? The guy who sided with the Nazis. The Vichy government in France with Hitler. There's always going to be people who will go with the other side, even though they're technically should be on their people's side. And so this is how the story is being portrayed in Maccabees. We're talking about Hanukkah. And so you've got, you essentially have your people divided. This is kind of what I'm trying to get at. And it, according to Maccabees, it's whether you follow the Torah, you know, and what are the things that are mentioned. Specifically here is circumcision, and that's what we're going to get to this morning. So he enacts a law that says essentially stop doing all of the things.
Who in Exodus?
Antiochus Epiphanes. And this is around, according to our calendar, it's around 169 BC. And so, if you remember, I think it's 164. It's about 5 years later that Judah comes along. He's the one that everybody calls Judah the Maccabee. And so it's about 5 years it's going to go past of where people are, I guess, compromising what the Bible says, the God's word, and all of that. And that also involves the temple. Okay, so let me just read this, and we'll get to where we're going this morning. Yes, so this is 1 Maccabees 1 and 33. Then Antiochus and his forces built high walls and strong towers in the area north of the temple, turning it into a fort. They brought in a group of traitorous Jews and installed them there. They also brought in arms and supplies and stored in the fort all the loot that they had taken in Jerusalem. This fort became a great threat to the city. And later on it says, the fort was a threat to the temple, a constant evil menace for Israel. Innocent people were murdered around the altar. The holy place was defiled by murderers. The people of Jerusalem fled in fear, and the city became a colony of foreigners. Jerusalem was foreign to its own people, who had been forced to abandon the city. Her temple was as empty as a wilderness. Her festivals were turned into days of mourning, her Sabbath joy into shame. Her honor became an object of ridicule. So,
it's... Who maybe wrote this?
Who wrote this? Or,
he, they, those people, if you put it out...
There's some... From what... In First Maccabees, it's an anonymous person, and it's written in Hebrew. We know that because the Greek, the only text we have is Greek. I think there's a Latin translation as well, but the Greek is very Semitic, and so it's a consensus that this is written by someone in the land in Hebrew at that time. So, here we go. The king sent messengers with a decree to Jerusalem and all the towns of Judea, ordering the people to follow customs that were foreign in the country. He ordered them not to offer burnt offerings, grain offerings, or wine offerings in the temple. And he commanded them to treat Sabbaths and festivals as ordinary work days. So are you picking all this up, right? The sacrifices, the holy days, they were even ordered to defile the temple and the holy things in it. They were commanded to build pagan altars, temples, and shrines. And this is what everybody knows here. And to sacrifice pigs. Right? Sacrifice pigs and other unclean animals there. They were forbidden to circumcise their sons and were required to make themselves ritually unclean in everywhere they could.
It's so a total package, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a total package of what you would call de-Judaizing.
Wiping out.
Against Jews.
I mean...
What do you call it today in United Nations? Ethnic cleansing. And also, there's another term when it comes to the culture being wiped out.
Cultural genocide?
What?
Cultural genocide?
Okay, do they have that term?
I don't know.
Okay, cultural genocide? All right. Let's see. Hold on. Okay, and then if you disobeyed, the decree was death. Now, here's where I want to come to. On the 15th day of the month of Kislev in the year, right? So Kislev is the month that Hanukkah starts. What day?
25th.
That's interesting because you got the 25th of December in the Roman calendar. The awful horror, or what we call in the Bible the abomination of desolation, was put on the altar of the temple. And pagan altars were built in the towns throughout Judea. Pagan sacrifices were offered in front of the houses and in the streets. Any books of the law which were found were torn up and burned. That also reminds you of, like, the Nazis, right?
Yeah.
Book burning.
And you know what the abominable idol of desolation
is? Well, I mean, everybody's always got their things. Maybe it's a pig. I don't know. Anyone who was caught with a copy of the sacred books or who obeyed the law was put to death by order of the king. All right, verse 59 of this chapter. On the 25th of the month, so that's Kislev, that's the first day of Hanukkah, even though we haven't got to that point in history, it comes 5 years later. These same evil people offered sacrifices on the pagan altar erected on the top of the altar in the temple. Mothers who had allowed their babies to be circumcised were put to death, in accordance with the king's decree. That also reminds you of another story in the Bible with mothers and babies.
Moses,
right? You're supposed to kill the firstborn. But here, the story's not so happy. Verse 61.
Back to Moses a second. Was Moses actually circumcised on the eighth day? I don't...
Well, according to...
The whole thing about his children.
Right, according to Exodus 3 or 4, I think it's 4, he actually gets circumcised as an adult, I think, with his sons.
Yeah.
The story's hard to follow there.
But it's just something.
But Sipora does it or something.
Yeah.
So here's what happens. The mothers who had allowed their babies to be circumcised, their babies were hung around their necks, and their families and those who had circumcised them were put to death. But many people in Israel firmly resisted the king's decree and refused to eat food that was ritually unclean. They preferred to die rather than break the holy covenant and eat unclean food, and many did die. So I want to remember this term, holy covenant. Brit Kodesh. And so we have this image of these mothers. They've had their male babies, and they're hung around their necks, and they were put to death because they were circumcised. And I want to go into the future from this time, skipping past the miracle of Hanukkah, and let's go up to the birth of Jesus, which is in Luke 2. And we all know the Christmas story. For those in America, made famous by Charlie Brown, or should I say Linus, that he reads from here in Luke 2. I read it last Shabbat at church as well. I'm not going to read it all, but we know the whole story. In the days of Caesar Augustus, there's a census, and they've got to go to their birth town to be taxed or registered, and so they go to Bethlehem. She gives birth to Jesus, puts him into a manger, and then there's shepherds, and then essentially they're proclaiming, the angels come and proclaim glory to God in the highest. And they go off to Bethlehem, and they see the baby, and they see Mary and Joseph. And then it says in Luke 2:19, but Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things they had heard and seen, which were just as they had been told. Then on verse 21, which we often don't read, on the eighth day, when it was time to circumcise the child, he was named Jesus, Yeshua, the name the angel had given him before he was conceived. And then it goes on in verse 22, they go up to the temple, and Mary does the purification rite, which is when you have a boy, after 33 days, you make a sacrifice in the temple. And she gives the sacrifice of the person who's not so well off, the two doves. But on the eighth day, Jesus is circumcised. And so I want to kind of keep this in mind. Here you have, if you go back a couple hundred years, these women in Jerusalem who had circumcised their sons were being thrown off, were being killed, put to death after circumcising their child. And here in the story of Jesus, he's being circumcised. And what does the picture bring together here for us? What does it mean to be circumcised? And what's the power?
It's a what?
Consecrated to the Lord, covenant.
Part of the covenant. You only become part of Israel.
Showing Jewishness.
Showing Jewishness, yeah, which means
entering
into the covenant with Torah, with the law. Part of us understanding what's happening here with Jesus in Luke 2 is we got to go back to Luke 1. What's the first chapter of Luke about? Who's the focus?
John the Baptist,
his cousin. It's fascinating because you often would think, well, Jesus is the Son of God. Why wouldn't he be in chapter 1? And what's the significance of John the Baptist? Why is he first talked about? I mean, I guess you could say chronologically he's older than Jesus. And so, but what's the story of Luke 1? How would you summarize Luke 1 and the origin of John the Baptist? What's the picture that's being painted overall of him and his family?
Miraculous birth.
Okay, miraculous birth. It's reminds you of the story of who?
Sarah.
Yeah, it reminds me of Sarah and Abraham and Isaac. He's like a type of Isaac. Okay.
And from birth, even before his birth, he's got a role. He is the one who's going to clear the way, prepare the way.
Right.
Is he Elijah? Isn't he Elijah? We're not sure, but
right.
He's got a function.
Yes.
It's not just a miraculous birth for no good end. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
In the same way as Yeshua is, he has a function. You will call his name, this child, or whatever.
So he has a function, but what's his family like? How would you describe his family?
Oh, it's a priestly family.
It's a priestly family. Okay, that's interesting. Priestly means you go up to the temple. He's one of the 24, what do they call them, courses? There's 24 groups of priests that go up every year to serve at different times. And his father's, if you go to chapter 1, verse 5, in the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was also a descendant of Aaron. Both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commands and decrees blamelessly. So the two things I would point out, as you already did, priestly. So that's a very important position in the society. And it says they're observant of the Torah. So again, kind of keep this in mind with what's going on with the Maccabees.
Yeah, it's interesting. I never seen that.
Yeah.
It's what, 100 years before, barely?
Right, 150, yeah.
Barely, 150 years before. You know, a woman could get killed for circumcising her child. Presumably a man could be killed for observing Torah, in whatever that means.
Right.
Going up to the temple, worshipping in the temple. And here we have, 100 years later, a complete turnaround.
Yes.
And sometimes when you hear the Hanukkah story, you know, it ends with the miracle of the lights and whatever, and then we go off and we sort of forget that there's a carryover. I mean, how long did, you know, because in the end, the Maccabees are defeated, and there comes again a Roman rule or whatever.
Right, right. So, in a sense, you have, historically, yeah, Gemma just kind of touched on something. The Greeks come in, which they're really from Syria at this point, and they come in and they defile the temple, right? That's the message. What happens later with the Romans? Pompey comes in. He's fighting in the area. He pops into Jerusalem and he wants to see this temple because it's well known that of all the temples in the world that they know of at that time, this is the only temple where there is no image. It's very unique. And so he walks into the Holy of Holies, Pompey. It's around 63 BC. And in a sense, that's considered a desecration of the temple as well. But it doesn't go down in our scripture like that, but overall in the tradition, you have this pagan guy, ruler, Gentile, showing up.
What year did he go in?
It's around 63.
And Pompey gets wiped out.
Yeah, and then later on, if you know the whole story with Pompey and Augustus and Mark Anthony, Pompey ends up getting killed as well. They all do. It all happens to all of them. And even if it's not your... I was just reading an article this week about all the Roman Caesars or emperors. 60-something percent of them died a violent death. You know, at some point, someone poisoned them or stabbed them, or it was hard living. It's like being a mafia don, you know, where you're just... That's just going to happen.
But didn't they also, although the Romans come in and desecrate it, isn't there something too about power and control and wanting it for themselves?
Oh, well, of course, when the Romans occupy this land, the Romans set up a garrison in Jerusalem, I mean, in conjunction with Herod. Herod wants them there because otherwise he doesn't have control of the people.
Right.
And they sit there at the fortress, the Antonio there, which... Today, the remnant, there's still some remnants of its foundation in the convent of the Sisters of Zion. So, but let's skip down in Luke 1 to 59, and so John is born, and in Luke 1:59 it says, on the eighth day they came to circumcise the child. and they were going to name him after his father Zechariah. But his mother spoke up and said, "No, he is to be called John." So, just like Jesus, both these guys are circumcised. It's fascinating. Because where does circumcision start in the Bible?
Oh, way back.
Abraham. Okay, let's just go there.
I went back to Exodus 4, too, about Moses went to Egypt, and Zipporah did the circumcision.
Right.
Surely you are husband of the blood.
Yeah, that story is very complicated and interesting. Before you turn to Luke 17, I just want to point out in Luke 1, when John is born, his father sings a song, right? He gets his voice back after he says his name is Yohanan, is John. And he does this amazing song in Luke 1, 68 to 80. And in that song, he says, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel." That's in Luke 1:68. "Because he has come to his people and redeemed them. He has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. Salvation from our enemies, from the hand of all who hate us. To show mercy to our ancestors." And this is what I want you to remember or underline. "And to remember his holy covenant." Where did we hear the holy covenant before this morning?
In the destruction of it, or the disobedience to it under the Maccabees.
In 1 Maccabees 1. We read also that phrase, the holy covenant. And what's it say here? "To remember his holy covenant, the oath he swore to our father Abraham." So now let's go to Genesis 17, to this holy covenant that he swore to our father Abraham. Genesis 17. Abraham was 99 years old. "The Lord appeared to him and said, 'I am God Almighty. Walk before me faithfully and be blameless. Then I will make my covenant between me and you will greatly increase your numbers.' Abram fell down, face down, and God said to him, 'As for me, this is my covenant with you.'" So covenants, Brit, has been mentioned here twice so far. "You will be the father of many nations. No longer will you be called Abram. Your name will be Abraham." What's curious about this? What's changed here?
He added a letter.
Okay. Essentially, he's added, well, Avraham, it's two letters, right?
Right.
Okay, maybe it's one letter in between. But his name is changed. And what happens, you go to a Brit Milah today or traditionally, what
he's given the name.
Exactly. Two things happen. You lose some flesh, but you get a name. The circumcision happens, and at the same time the name is given.
The first time the name is told.
And so we have back in Luke 1 and 2, John and Jesus it says when they're circumcised, they're given their names.
Right.
And this is actually your earliest, it's kind of like the example of the Maccabees. The Maccabees it's a Christian preserved text that preserves the earliest Jewish tradition of that sort. So here in Luke 1 and 2, it's the New Testament that speaks to the name being given to a baby when they're circumcised, which is what's practiced today in the Orthodox tradition. But here in Genesis 17, this is kind of where you can interpret it like, whoa, Abraham got his name changed when the circumcision is given, whenever he's 99 at this point, right? But it's kind of...
There are two things there, Alan. First of all, it's not Orthodox tradition, it's Jewish tradition.
Right.
I mean, you'd be very hard-pressed to find kids in this country, whether they're Orthodox or secular as you like, who don't have a Brit Milah, and they get given their name. Very, very rare. I've never known anybody.
What?
Okay. But there aren't very many. It's a Jewish tradition, and it's obviously got very deep roots. But what's also interesting is God can change names at other times apart from as a pagan land.
Right.
I mean, Jacob is a good example. Presumably, we don't know, but Jacob has been circumcised. I don't think we get it particularly.
Right.
But he does have his name changed.
Right. So you're right. This is not to say that when you're circumcised, that's the only time you can get another name.
No, no,
but it's interesting in this case that with the circumcision, and I'm using the term covenant, often we think of covenant in the Bible, you know, it's used multiple times. What's the most famous covenant, I would say, besides circumcision? Sinai, right? It's God comes down, he gives the Ten Commandments, and there's this covenant. And then us Christians, we like to point at Jeremiah, right? Chapter 31, where the prophet is saying, there's going to come a day where I'm going to give you a Brit Chadashah, I'm going to give you a new covenant, and this is where we get our name today for this book we call the New Testament.
We the nations follow circumcision very much. We know what different nations have done. I've heard quite a few in America for cleanliness.
Right.
Do we know otherwise?
Yeah.
Well, in the ancient world, the Egyptian priest circumcised, and there were some other groups.
Many.
And
I think it's doesn't Islam
at a certain
older,
right? I think more like Ishmael towards right.
Muslims do,
yeah. But more towards the Ishmael tradition, right? When he's towards teenage years, like older kid.
Country, right?
Yeah, Turkey is different.
Palestinians do when they're babies, but
yeah.
But the point here is, which I think so many Christians forget, is that we're talking about a Jewish tradition, a Jewish practice, something that's rooted in Torah, rooted in the Word, starting with Abraham and going all the way through, and now we've got John and we've got Yeshua, both being clearly said, they are now coming into the Holy Covenant, to want this word.
Right. For those who walked in late, we're talking about, it just so happens this year, in 2019, we have Christmas, we have New Year's, and in the midst of it, we've got Hanukkah. And Hanukkah, 8 days, is based off of the people in this land going against the Gentile influence, and circumcision was a main part of what the rebellion or the defiance was against. And ultimately, you have this covenant of the flesh, this covenant of circumcision, and you have this covenant of Sinai, Torah, which they kind of get melded together, right? Like today, when you get circumcised, the idea is that you're going to keep the law. And at least in the Orthodox tradition, it's probably very specific what that means. And looking at Genesis 17, I just want to keep reading here, you kind of see that being brought together here, where he says, I'm going to establish my covenant. This is verse 7, Genesis 17, 7. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. Okay, go to verse 8. God said to Abraham, as for you, you must keep my covenant. Well, what does that mean here in Genesis 17? You must keep my covenant.
You've got to go on circumcising your kids.
Right.
Verse 10 explains it.
Yeah, verse 10 explains it. This is my covenant with you, the covenant you are to keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You are to undergo circumcision, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and you. For the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 years old...
Where's Emma? Emma, it's an emergency. Thanks, I'll wake up.
Yeah. Hopefully it's not an emergency. So in this case, verse 14, any uncircumcised male who has not been circumcised in the flesh will be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. God also said to Abraham, as for Sarah, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. Okay. Yes. Because if we go forward into history past Jesus, after he's gone, you go to Acts 15, and the church comes together, and essentially the church is all Jewish at this point. And who's the head of the church in Jerusalem? James, the brother of Jesus. And who has come to this conference that they call together in Jerusalem? This is Paul and Barnabas, right? They show up.
About circumcision.
And what's the conference about?
About keeping the law as much about food as well as circumcision.
Okay, but what? Right. If remember in the beginning of Acts, Paul and Barnabas have gone out into like Turkey and Cyprus. They haven't gotten to Greece yet, from what I remember. But they're kind of in the Asia Minor area. And there's a lot of things happening. A lot of Gentiles are coming to the Lord, coming to know Jesus. And in specifically, the city of Antioch in Syria becomes a hub for these new believers that are Gentiles. And so Paul and Barnabas are called from Antioch down to Jerusalem. And like what you just said, what do we do now? Because Jesus was Jewish, he's the Jewish Messiah, and do they need to be circumcised? That's Acts 15. And if they're going to be circumcised, what does that mean?
Do they keep the law, any of it, all of it, none of it?
And technically, if you keep circumcision, you keep all of it.
Yeah,
that's kind of the package. And so what's the decision that's made after they meet and pray together? Okay, so there's about four things that are given.
For it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these necessary things, that you abstain from things offered to idols, from blood, from things strangled, and from sexual immorality. If you keep yourselves from these, you will do well. Farewell.
Okay, so there's these four things. It doesn't say, like, don't murder. Doesn't say, don't lie, like the Ten Commandments. Sexual immorality, you could put it in the Ten Commandments. But so what's going on here? Because it doesn't really explain itself. They don't go into interpreting why they've chosen these. But what they do decide on one thing for sure, which is what? No circumcision.
They don't have to be circumcised.
You don't have to be circumcised. You are not becoming a Jew. That's kind of the main decision that comes out of it, is that Gentiles who come to follow Jesus, like you see in Paul's letter to the Galatians, he's like, you know, you do not get circumcised. You're circumcised if you want in the heart, which is also an idea that's in the Hebrew scriptures for Jews as well. It's not just for Gentiles. But so what is going on? What do you think is going on with these four things?
That's the instruction given to Gentiles who come to join the faith, but Jews who are of the faith, who continue to be part of the faith, they do continue.
Right, and
they do continue to circumcise and follow the law.
And so, where do we see this? This also continues in Acts when Paul is going off. He finds his kid Timothy. Remember, Timothy's mother and his grandmother are Jewish. And I can't remember if his father is or not. I don't think he is. His father is, right? And what does Paul do with Timothy? He circumcises him. Okay, and then Paul's... So that's one of Paul's chief disciples, as the story plays out. There's another kid that, I don't know if he's a kid, but young guy. Who does he find out there to bring in as another one of his disciples? Titus. Do you remember Titus? And he specifically says Titus is not Jewish, and he doesn't circumcise Titus. And so you've got these kind of two sides of Paul. You've got his Jewish side, that those who are Jewish he's reaching out to, and those who he's reaching out to are Gentiles. And he's got both hands extended. So Paul, let's go back, let's fast forward to the end of his life. Paul comes back to Jerusalem, his final time, and he gets arrested in the temple. Why is he arrested? Acts 20, Acts 21.
Has he been up there to fulfill some vow he's taken?
He teaches the people not to follow the law.
Right. So there's a rumor that someone says there that Paul's been going around teaching Jews not to follow the law. And Paul says, no, that's not right. And James says, well, prove it. Go and pay for these guys' sacrifices at the temple. And so Paul, while he's up there doing that, he gets arrested because there's this person, a little riot starts. It basically says, this guy has been telling Jews not to follow the law. So all of that to bring us into this context, right? We've got Jesus getting circumcised. We've got John getting circumcised. Circumcision means what? Timothy gets circumcised. You're committing yourself to this covenant. And going back, your parents are committing yourself to the covenant. And it's not politically correct today to basically tell your kids what to do, right?
Bring your child up in the way it should go.
Yeah. And the whole story with Hanukkah is this idea of committing yourself to this holy covenant and to following the Torah, to following the law.
That's interesting also for that circumcising kid where you said for the baptism debate, we who belong to the evangelical tradition make such a big deal about the fact about letting a kid get baptized when he's cognizant and
he has to make a ethical choice,
decision,
a personal decision. Yes.
And we, we rebel against both
the evangelicals. You're talking about, right?
We rebel against both Catholic and Orthodox tradition, and yet it's stemming from circumcision. Where?
So going back to Heidi's thing,
nobody's asking you if you're 8 days old,
right? Heidi, you were saying that when a baby is baptized, or someone's baptized in the Orthodox Church, they get a name, right? And was that the same deal, Danny, with your boys when they were baptized?
They do ask your name. I don't know if people don't know the name until then.
It's not kept a secret, you're saying?
No, because you get baptized at 6 months old. You get
baptized.
You get a Christian name, exactly.
Okay, so... so this is the interesting thing. Going back to Acts 15, when Gentiles are coming into the church, no to circumcision. But what does come along in the tradition of, especially, it probably builds into the Gentile church, because as it becomes more and more Gentile and less Jewish, there is this need for a circumcision, because a circumcision is kind of that demarcated line that says, I am now on this side rather than that side.
So what you could say, couldn't you, is that in the current church situation of all denominations, right across the board, there is an understanding that a child is brought to the Lord. It's dedicated, it may be baptized, it may be whatever. Leave out the outward sign of it. There's something around about bringing a child to the Lord. And then, in all traditions, at some point that child has to make its own adult decision, which you could equivalent with the bar mitzvah, which is the decision that now I'm going to be responsible for my faith. It can be it can be baptism by immersion, like we would say, only when the child is ready to be responsible. But I guess in some of the more orthodox traditions, you've got the whole thing about confirmation and so on and so on. And the real issue is exactly the same for bar mitzvah now. Is that child really understanding what they're entering into? Even a bar mitzvah in many, many secular families becomes nothing more than a huge party, and they may read the parasha of the week if you're lucky. But the fact that you are taking on responsibility for the Holy Covenant is another issue. And in Christian terms, it's almost deeper. I mean, if you go back to John, where we were last week, that we got the law from the Torah, and now we have grace on grace. So for the believer, you're really entering into the whole of covenant with Israel on a spiritual level.
So let's go to Acts 15 again. Okay. What are the, you know, sexual immorality, none of that. Don't eat food sacrificed to idols.
Nothing strangled, sexual immorality.
Strangled and blood. And then there's some texts that have murder, don't murder, for the blood part.
Well, some of those are kind of...
what are they all related to?
They're ceremonial.
They're ceremonial.
And so they're sort of like, these aren't moral issues, like a thing sacrificed an idol or eating blood.
Right.
There's nothing moral about that. There's nothing, but this is still a ceremonial thing that we still want you to commit to, we still want you to keep, because there are still ceremonial things that set you apart, just like the Jewish law does.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, there's nothing
that us Gentiles still believe in ceremony.
Yeah.
That it actually is a part of our foundation. That, you know, we'll talk about, I can't have my cheeseburger if you're Jewish, or, you know, you can't eat shrimp, or, you know, there's certain things, but we actually have it embedded in Acts 15 here. This is very much ceremonial, the blood, because lots of Gentile Christians eat, rare steak, or
sacrificial, so they are separating themselves in these countries from, must be a huge prevailing culture of...
You're talking about in Acts, right?
Yeah.
But I'm talking about today. Do you not eat a rare steak? Do you make it well done? Or what's the Scottish haggis, right?
Or blood pudding in Sweden.
Blood pudding. Yeah. Like, do Christians actually...
Culture, the taste of sweet.
No.
Even the Gentiles weren't supposed to do that, though.
Right.
That's exactly what you say.
But what I'm saying at the end of the day, this is people aren't actually abiding by this. Because
they're not even abiding by that.
They're not even abiding by that. Because what's the context of Acts? That's what I'm trying to get at here. And this kind of brings us all back to the Maccabees. What's the context? What is sexual immorality? What is blood? What is something strangled? What is something sacrificed to idol? What are they all, probably all have in common here?
The pagan worship.
Because remember what Paul says in his other writings in Corinthians about, you know, this one, you can eat meat sacrificed to idols, but then this other brother can't do it, you know, because
it
causes them to stumble. And it's all connected to this idea of this pagan worship. And it's the same thing in the Maccabees. You know, when Antiochus comes in, he wants to change the worship. He wants to make it basically pagan, whatever, that's a late or early term that doesn't belong there, but something that is not according to the Bible. And so it's interesting, in both cases, even as Christians play out down the road, and baptism replaces circumcision for us, right? I'm a Baptist. I mean, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church. It's in the name of our denomination that you've got to be baptized. That is that moment in time that you step from one side to the other. That's my circumcision and my tradition. And I would argue, in a lot of evangelicals, it still is a significant, that idea is there. What are you saying?
Marker.
Right, yeah, that marker. And so, anyways, as we kind of bring all of this together, as we think about Hanukkah, and we think about Jesus and John, and Jesus' circumcision is coming up in a couple of days on the liturgical calendar, and it is also in that liturgical calendar, Jesus' circumcision, from a tradition, is the first time his blood is shed. And that's something interesting to think about. It's the first time his blood is shed. And that it is his redemption of the world, cleansing of sins, starts already when he's 8 days old. And that idea of blood being shed, it's even in Jewish tradition as well, that the blood of circumcision, let me pull out a couple, just read you a couple of the examples here. Okay, according to the Midrash Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer in 29, it was Shem who circumcised Abraham and Ishmael on the Day of Atonement. And the blood of the covenant, when shed, is ever before God on that day to serve as an atoning power. According to the same Midrash, Pharaoh prevented the Hebrew slaves from performing the rite. But when the Passover time came and brought them deliverance, they underwent circumcision and they mingled the blood of the Paschal Lamb with that of the Abrahamic covenant. Wherefore, in Ezekiel 16:6, God repeats the words, in your blood live. Nachmanides, I believe he's medieval rabbi. Circumcision is a covenant not for the Jew to remember God, but for God to remember the Jew. For the circumcision is an offering of sacrifice. The blood of the circumcision atones for sins. The sacrificed animal needed to be at least 8 days old, like the male baby. Circumcision is an act of true sacrifice because it is performed on the boy, a human being. And I'm sure, especially guys who get circumcised later in life, probably think it's a human sacrifice as well. But it's just one of these things to reflect on, that we often forget little things like circumcision and their significance, its significance in the whole redemption story of Jesus, and that he's a Jew and that he observes the Torah. He's not a lawbreaker. Paul, the same thing. He said, no, I didn't go around teaching Jews not to keep the law. And it was specifically to Gentiles that he was saying, you do not need to keep the law. And I want to end with this last point. In the tradition, we all know that there were Gentiles, and even today, there are more Gentiles, Christians, who come to this land and become Jews than the opposite, that I've found from my experience. And there's even a group of, they just had a little conference over Sukkot of this group of, you know, former evangelical Assembly of God, Baptists, whatever they were, who've converted to Judaism, where they gather and they talk about, you know, they're now Jews. And it was happening in the time of the Bible as well. There were God-fearing Gentiles, and I'm talking specifically in the New Testament. And there were three things that you had to do to be convert at that time. You had to be circumcised. You had to do a sacrifice. And then you had to dip yourself, what we call baptism. But it was becoming more of a practice in that time. Sorry? Exactly, exactly, exactly. A mikveh was, in the Second Temple period, you, you go around to all these sites with guides and they point out, oh, this is a mikveh, this is a mikveh, this is a place where you could immerse yourself on a daily basis to stay clean in a purity sense. And so that, those are your three things to become Jewish if you were a Gentile. And so, anyways, just to kind of finish here, in Acts 15, Paul said, you don't need to be circumcised. I mean, or James, brother Jesus, said that, and then everybody agreed upon it. You don't have to be circumcised. We all know the temple's destroyed in 70, so there's no, you can't do a sacrifice anymore. And so at the end of it, you're left with this baptism, this dipping, and not in a ceremonial sense, but for us as Gentiles who've come into the faith, it becomes that marker for us where we've crossed over into the people of God and to follow the Lord. And that's it. So, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.